by the Stony Point people, Kettle Point people, and the Sarnia people gave up 2 million acres of land in return for, I think it's 200,000 acres, in, that would remain intact. It would never be touched into perpetuity. And the British Crown recognized that and said, okay, we will honor that. Canada, when Canada formed in 1867, they said that they would honor that. They would inherit that and honor that. What happened was that the person that they put into the community, or who was responsible for the community, was a person known as the Indian Agent. Now, the Indian Agent's job was to ensure that the colonial mindset people were kept in power in the communities, okay? They were given the power. And what that meant is that they came in, they implemented the Indian Act, which effectively took away the voice and the power of the women's roles and responsibilities in our community. Remember, when we had this circle, way of living, we had gender equity, okay? We have child and parents are of equal height, okay? Children have a certain responsibility to their parents. Parents have a certain responsibility to their children. So what you have is you have a relationship based on parity, based on equality, and based on kinship. You know, family, values, family, association, family membership. So when we entered into a treaty, we called the British Crown Father because we knew that they would have certain responsibilities in taking care of us, and we would have certain responsibilities in protecting them because we, at that time, we had the military might. We had the military strength. And so the British government knew that, and so that's why they entered into treaties whereby some of the treaty rights, Aboriginal rights, were no taxation, hunting and fishing rights. We would be unmolested in our territories, those land communities that we would call our own. And so the British government now comes from a European mindset whereby in their way of living, parents and children are different, whereby they felt that parents had the right to mold and control the children. So right away, when we negotiated the treaties, we thought that we were talking and building this relationship on equality, based on equality. They were talking about it, thinking that they were talking about the European way of doing things, whereby they had the power. They were the ones who were the father by virtue of that fact. Therefore, they were kind of like on this system here, where they were the parents and children were down here. But unfortunately, that's not the way we saw it, and so that was a conflict that wasn't easily resolved, and we're still trying to resolve that today. Western civilization came in and they saw how powerful the women were. They said the first thing we should do is we should take away their power. We'll put in the Indian Act, and the Indian Act will take away women's roles and responsibilities and effectively their voice. And that's what happened. So they gave the power to the men. The men ended up adapting to this system, and today we still have this system, which is very much a strategy that does not work for First Nations people today. So we're left with attempts now from out here, the indigenous, the traditional people who want to reclaim their indigenous knowledge systems. And the way they want to do that is they want to decolonize by giving back roles and responsibilities and power back to the women. The roles and responsibilities that women always had. Because women in our culture are considered sacred. They carry the future generations. They looked after the homes. They looked after the families. They looked after the children. They looked after the resources. Whereas men had that equity of looking after and providing for the community, protecting the community, defending, peacekeeping, and teaching. They had the responsibility of teaching. So we see in many of the communities, we see how the traditional people are starting to revive those that and try to bring the strategy of reviving women's roles and responsibilities back. So that's the strategy that we're going through today. Now, this Indian agent, his job was to keep the women and the men fighting and colonized, okay? And anyone who went against this rule of law, they would be ostracized by the Indian agent, and they could not ever, it was very hard for them to get office within this new system of government, governance called elected system of government. We had a traditional form of government, which was where the men who were the servants, were the speakers, were guided by the women, by the clan mothers. The clan mothers, we had a built-in impeachment process where the clan mothers could take away the power of the men. That was a built-in impeachment process. So we had checks and balances. But that system was displaced when this Indian Act came into being. So over the course of time, the Indian agent met his obligations very faithfully, his responsibilities of what the federal government wanted him to do. And he allowed all the, in the Stony Point community, he allowed two very controversial land transactions to take place where what is today Ipawash Provincial Park, which is the land that has been reclaimed as of 1995. Ipawash Provincial Park was bought by a developer who later became the mayor of Sarnia, who saw an opportunity for this frontage of along Stony Point, along the shores of Lake Huron, beautiful, beautiful prime real estate. But the Indian agent convinced the Stony Point people, he only had to convince the men, remember, okay, because the men were the ones who had the power. And he convinced the men that drifting white sand is not good for anything. Drifting white sand. Now remember, there's all these beautiful sand dunes along the shores of Lake Huron. And he was able to effectively convince them to sell this land, to sign on to sell it. So there's a band council resolution, which is like our way of becoming of one mind. That was the new governance, where it only took six or seven people to say that they would agree to that. And then the Indian agent would recommend it for approval to the Department of Indian Affairs, who then made the law applicable, whereby the land would be surrendered. Okay, so these two big, huge tracts of land that were sold, and it was under very one judge who looked at this as a land claim said that in 1996, he said it had the odor of foul play all around it, but he wasn't ruling on that particular land transaction. He was ruling on something else. But when he looked at that, he just said that it really smelled of collusion and corruption and fraud. So suffice it to say that land claim is still proceeding through the courts very, very slowly. In fact, it's kind of ironic that the Department of Indian Affairs is the judge, the jury, and they're the ones who give the legal opinion on whether a land claim is valid or not. So you can see how power is stacked up against the Native people in this case. We could not hire a lawyer till 1960. We could not, in this community, we could not go to an MP because we were not considered citizens of Canada. We could not vote until 1960. And there was no land claim policy in effect until 1974. So what you have is you have everything stacked against the Stony Point people. And so in 1936, negotiations began with the provincial government to talk the Stony Pointers out of leaving their traditional territory and moving down the road to a place called Kettle Point, which is about 5 miles down the road. And the idea was that the Department of National Defense thought that this land was very suitable for a camp for war training exercises. And Canada at that time was just about to enter into World War II. So what you have is the Department of National Defense convincing the federal government that, well, if they don't want to give up the land, because the Stony Point people had a couple of referendums in the community whereby unanimously they said that they would not give up their land, because one thing that stuck based on the circle way of living, the traditional indigenous knowledge, was that the land is our mother. You do not sell the land. You never surrender your land. So the people, even though there was all this kind of, the Indian agent tried to create, he tried to divide and conquer the community, he was unsuccessful in getting them to surrender their land. So the Department of National Defense said in 1942, they said that, well, we can expropriate it under the War Measures Act, and we can, that's how we'll settle the situation. And the Indian agent, he recommended that, and he said, well, that'll be good, because all you have are a few straggling Indians in Stony Point who can easily be amalgamated into the Kettle Point community. Now, remember, the Kettle Point community do not want, they don't have much land themselves, and they surely don't want the burden of taking care of all these Stony Point people, which there was about 83, something like that, was at that time. And so the Canadian government went ahead and they took the land, they expropriated it, and became Canadian land. And remember that no other Native community in Canada had ever had any part of their reserve expropriated under federal law. Stony Point was the first case in point where they went ahead and did that to see, I guess they wanted to see if there would be, if they could set some kind of precedent. And unfortunately, that went through.
We have put a question to both Canada and the United States, and it's the same question. It's a very narrow question. Mm-hmm. We're asking the United States, is Article 2 of the U.S. Constitution, is it still part of the Constitution? Article 2, Section 2, Paragraph 2, Clause 1. That has to do with a constitution-to-constitution relationship with us. And in Canada, we ask the same question. Does Section 109, is it still part of the Canadian Constitution? Now, when that question gets up there, then this will cause a complete shift. It means that things will go back to the way they were. So that means that federal Indian law, which is illegal in both Canada and the United States, so that every treaty, every agreement, every contract, you know, everything that was carried out that violated this constitution-to-constitution relationship is null and void. So where does that leave Canada and the United States? So now we're at the point where this decision may be made very soon, and we're at the point now of planning the transition.